Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International's newsroom. The Australian Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, says it would be an absolute disaster for Australia if a free trade deal with China is blocked by the Senate. He was recently on a visit to China. He says reassuring some of the most senior figures in the government there about his government's determination to steer a deal through on time. Andrew Robb and the Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, are both piling pressure on the Labour opposition to back a deal in its current form. But the Construction, Forestry, Mining and Energy Union, the CFMEU, is pushing Labour to block the agreement. Louisa Yaxley reports.
Tony Abbott cites the former Labour Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who's quoted in the Australian newspaper today, urging the ALP opposition to back the Chinese trade deal.
Well, I'm very pleased that former Prime Minister Bob Hawke has said what he said, because he understands what I understand and what most people know to be the case, that trade means jobs and more trade means more jobs. And the China Free Trade Agreement is all about more jobs. If Labour is to try to reject the China Free Trade Agreement, they will be sabotaging our economic future. They will be turning their back on what is one of the greatest opportunities our country has ever been offered. And I say to Bill Shorten, listen to decent Labor people like Bob Hawke and Bob Carr. Stop dancing to the tune of the CFMEU.
Michael O'Connor from the CFMEU insists the deal should not be approved in the Senate without changes.
Well, we've clearly put to the Labor Party that if we're going to have an agreement with China, it has to be an agreement that's good for the economy, good for the community, good for the country. And clearly this is the worst trade agreement ever negotiated by an Australian government. It's a dud. And what we said to the Labor Party, they've got to stand up for Australian workers, they've got to stand up for the community. And there's been a process before where Liberal governments have engaged with the opposition to try and improve free trade agreements. And I think it's very clear, our message to Labor is this: you've got to stand up for the community, stand up for workers and improve this agreement, because if this agreement goes through as it is, this will be a disaster for the country.
But the Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, who's in Beijing promoting the deal, says it's not negotiable.
Well, we signed the treaty. We have done the deal with, and the provisions are there. I mean, we're having a debate, for goodness sake. We're having a debate all over the country. There's nothing that the union movement or Labor has advanced which shows that there is an issue. We've got the Migration Council coming out and saying it is exactly the same as what has been applying now. They're the ones who oversee the provisions and the execution of these Labor testing measures and all the rest. They are satisfied. The authorities are satisfied. You've got so many industrial lawyers are satisfied with the provisions. This is pure politics. If they had something that was legitimate, it would have been exposed properly and it would have been agreed by people outside of our domain,
so
by independent people. It's being rammed down people's throats with suggestions that we're going to lose thousands of jobs. This is nonsense. We're going to gain thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs.
So what is the point of the treaties process having a look at this and then it going through the parliament? If it can't be altered at all, then isn't that just meaningless?
No, it is to see whether it's in the national interest. And we had consulted endlessly, thousands of consultations in the negotiation of this deal. And it goes through the parliament to ensure that it is in the national interest. Nothing that Labor or the unions have put forward yet in any way suggests that this is against the national interest. In fact, quite the contrary.
Australia's already signed the free trade agreement with China, but enabling legislation needs to pass the parliament. Mr. Robb says if it doesn't pass, significant economic opportunities will be lost.
There's major joint ventures have been put together to take fresh food and agricultural produce directly to the homes of millions of Chinese using the internet, using the great expertise and contacts of some of the companies here in China in combination with Australian companies. This is going to massively increase the farm gate price because it'll be direct. The middleman will go. All of these sorts of deals are being put together now in anticipation that this deal will be passed. If it's not passed, it will be such a damaging, deeply damaging impact on the relationship, the business relationship, but also the wider relationship. China will not understand how we can enter into a treaty which they have given us preferential treatment over any other country in the world, and we snub that offer because of crass politics in Australia.
Almost 86,000 calls to Australia's child abuse phone line have gone unanswered in the last 4 years. A royal commission is looking at the state of the child protection system after several high-profile deaths and failures. The state government says mandatory reporting system is needed to be changed, not to get more calls answered, but to reduce the number of calls being made in the first place. From Adelaide, Natalie Whiting reports.
An inquest in Adelaide is investigating how a baby girl was left to die in her parents' care despite numerous red flags. It's the latest in a series of high-profile cases involving the beleaguered Families SA. Now, Families First MP Rob Brokenshire says thousands of people calling to report abuse are hanging up in frustration because they're waiting too long to talk to an operator.
Families SA and the government have failed in almost every way when it comes to child abuse in this state. We've now forced a royal commission on them, and some of these practices need to be corrected now, not waiting years for a royal commission to report.
The party has obtained documents under the Freedom of Information Act that show almost 86,000 calls to the abuse reporting line went unanswered in the last 4 years. And despite extra staff and online reporting being brought in, more than 15,000 calls went unanswered last financial year. The Minister for Child Protection Reform, John Rau, says the line's clearly receiving too many reports, and he says the mandatory reporting system needs to be overhauled.
I think we have to narrow the potential scope of those people who have to report. And then secondly, we have to look at the scope of the things they have to report about. Many people in the community, I think, would imagine that what we're talking about is that a child's turned up to school bruised or with a broken bone, or that is not necessarily the case. Some of these reports might be the child has come to school several days in a row and doesn't appear to have had any lunch, things of that nature. Now, I'm not saying it's great kids go to school without lunch, but I'm trying to explain to you that there's a vast difference between a child bobbing up at school without lunch and a child that's been physically abused.
But he says the government will need to speak with the Royal Commissioner first.
It would be very unsatisfactory if we were to turn the whole show over and start again, only to have her bring out recommendations which were different to that and have to do it yet again. I mean, we have to think of the staff in the department having some degree of certainty about what the future looks like. So I'm up for big change. The government's up for big change, but we don't want to have big change followed by further big change or back to where we started. So we have to be mindful of the Royal Commission.
The department is also looking at employing people just to answer the calls rather than using social workers. Child protection expert Elspeth McInnes from the University of South Australia says the long phone waits could deter people from reporting.
Well, a sense of frustration is certainly one dominant emotion that people speak of. There's also grief and fear because in many cases people know these young children and really are desperate to protect them from the concerns that they see. One consequence is the development of a cynicism or a lack of faith in the system, which again serves to undermine the whole system of protecting and looking out for vulnerable children.
But she's urged caution about overhauling the mandatory reporting system.
By limiting and saying, well, let's just shut down the number of people who can make a report, and that way we won't know about those other cases, can narrows the pathways for a child to get help. And that help may be no less pressing or urgent or fatal, potentially, than the ones that, the mandate professionals know about. So I'm much more about let's make sure that when people are making reports, they actually understand that process in a more informed way, rather than limit the number of people who can make a report if they have a concern. They might be a lifeline.
The state government says even if it reduced the number of mandatory reporters, it would still encourage other people to report voluntarily. The Royal Commission's findings are expected to be handed down in August next year.
After 5 months of political charge hearings, a Senate committee in Australia is looking into serious allegations of abuse at the Nauru Detention Centre. Will publish its report this week. The Greens and Labor-dominated inquiry has recommended downgrading the security at the processing centre and handed over control of humanitarian services to a special welfare agency. But even before the recommendations were handed down, the immigration minister dismissed them. Peter Dutton described the whole process as a witch hunt. Tom Igludin has the story.
The 133-page report is the latest in a series of investigations into alleged sexual abuse on Nauru and the extent to which the government knew of such allegations. The most substantial recommendation of this latest effort is, in the report's words, that the centre move toward becoming a more open, lower security living arrangement for all asylum seekers, except where there is a compelling reason for an asylum seeker to be accommodated more securely. The committee's deputy chair, Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, says that it make life better for families there.
Families living as prisoners in a tent prison where all of their movements are monitored. And it means that they are at the behest of the guards. And it is the abuse at the hands of the guards that is the most alarming. That's the most horrific and horrifying evidence that came out through this inquiry.
The report also suggests the Immigration Department conduct a full audit of the wide range of allegations of misconduct and potential criminal activity at the centre and calls for another inquiry by another Senate committee. The Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, spoke to The World Today before the recommendations came out.
You'll see in the recommendations that the political flavour to them.
He says the inquiries lacked credibility from the start and took issue with the evidence given by John Nichols, a former guard at the island employed by Wilson Security, who gave evidence earlier this month about alleged torture of Palestinian asylum seekers.
I've seen members of the ERT exit tents, and later I've seen asylum seekers come out of them tents covered in water, coughing. I've heard members of the ERT boast and brag about how they've waterboarded people.
At the time, the Liberal member of the inquiry, Senator Linda Reynolds, cross-examined Mr Nichols.
Did you at any time seek to go outside and report these things that you said that you found horrific?
No, I hadn't, no.
Mr Dutton says Mr Nichols' performance is evidence of political grandstanding that was the inquiry's real aim.
The witness turned up, provided no evidence, recanted the original version given, frankly was not a credible witness, and we've heard nothing of those baseless allegations. So, again, I think people should deal with the facts.
The government never wanted this inquiry to happen because they didn't want people who work inside the facility to have an opportunity to speak the truth. The government has been desperate to cover up the horrors inside Nauru for quite some time. And, of course, the negligence of both the department, the minister, and their private contractors.
One of those contractors, Transfield Services, was by coincidence today given a 5-year extension to provide services on Nauru. The immigration minister's dismissing suggestions the department should have waited until the report was handed down.
I don't have any comment to make in relation to the tender processes that are undertaken by the department. Completely an issue for the department. They'll have criteria on which they make decisions about who will be given contracts.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Kiribati has moved to pass a bill to create a youth justice system and keep children out of adult prisons. Young offenders are put through the adult justice system in Kiribati, and 10 are in prison for crimes such as stealing bike parts. The Juvenile Justice Act will set standards for the youth justice system, which include a new youth court and a focus on community-based punishments instead of prison sentences. UNICEF's child protection specialist, Salote Kayamakuta, told Daniela Mateira-Cox, Kiribati is setting an example for the rest of the Pacific, but implementing the changes will be a challenge.
Young people represent about between 40-43% of the population of all our Pacific countries, so we want to emphasize the need to use diversion programs, so young people can stay at school and stay in paid employment and just use their maybe their soccer or their rugby time when they go out and play with peers to put back time into their community.
If you are a young person and you're put into prison, are you more likely to reoffend once you come out?
Well, I'll go by the program we used to have in Fiji. We did a survey and young people were being imprisoned for less than 12 months. The recidivism rate was about 52 to 54%. So it's also a worry because they come out linking up and networking with older, more experienced offenders. So you really want to prevent any of that networking starting in the first place. But you also want to ensure that they stay on at school and at paid employment if they are working.
So what are the best ways to make sure that does happen?
In this way, the new Juvenile Justice Bill for Kiribati mandates duty bearers, magistrates, police and unamanes, these are the elders, lay magistrates in the outer islands in Kiribati, to follow the law and to use the diversion options that are provided for in the new legislation.
What are some of the common crimes that these young offenders are alleged to have committed or have committed?
Well, in Kiribati, you know, one of the biggest challenges for the police were these young boys who steal bicycles and sell spare parts and they take it away and sell a bicycle or they will take it apart and sell the spare parts. When the police first told me, I thought, wow, you've got some intelligent children here, so you need to work with them on how you could use them in a more constructive way.
So stealing bike parts, that's enough to earn some time in prison?
Well, you know, it's Kiribati. They think that's really naughty. You know, it's their perspective. Kiribati was also known in the past for putting their young people in what they called a banana circle. Well, a banana circle is a very deep trench, and they grow bananas around it and they put all their food rubbish in it. But the newly dug out ones, sometimes they put their children in the pit. They can't get out of it. You know, that's pretty scary if you're a young kid. That's stopped since we've been taking out awareness raising on how to treat children in contact with the law and in conflict with the law. There are other ways to manage and discipline if you're not happy with what the child's behaviour has been.
And is that message spreading throughout the Pacific? How are the other countries faring?
Yes, it is. Solomon Island has a draft child and welfare bill right now that we're advocating for enactment. The Kiribati has been the one that's been in the front in terms of the enactment of a child, young persons and family welfare act. That's really a protection measure for children who are victims and young people who are victims and treating the family in terms of a whole systems approach. The Juvenile Justice Act is really about handling children in conflict with the law and trying to keep them out of prison, but also taking up message on how to prevent offending in the first place.
What are the challenges in implementing these new systems? Is there enough training for people to help deal with them?
You know, our challenge for the Pacific is the geographic spread, and it's very costly to fly in and do capacity building. And like for magistrates, lay magistrates, there's probably about 100 in Kiribati, and there's 200 in Vanuatu. It's about access to justice. So it's really about sustaining the capacity building because people move on. And in Kiribati, to be a lay court magistrate in the outer islands, they call them unamanes or elders, you got to be 60 before you can qualify to sit on the island court circuits. And they sit as a panel, like three of them. So to leave it too late for training at 60 might be a challenge. So you need to continue, you need to start with the upstream, downstream young people, parents, teachers and police and your magistrates and lay magistrates. You know, child protection is, we say, everyone's business. You don't just confine it to the justices, but you also have to work holistically with the whole systems approach. So especially with young people too, they go over 18 very quickly. So we hope that they'll be the ones to run the messages when they become teachers or decision makers later on in their life.
6 months have passed since Cyclone Pam brought widespread destruction to Vanuatu, and businesses in the country are still struggling to recover. Much of Vanuatu's essential infrastructure services have been restored, but the country's lifeblood, tourism, is still struggling to reach the pre-cyclone levels. Kauini Hawkins has the story.
Blue skies, pristine beaches and turquoise waters are part of the checklist for travellers planning a Pacific getaway, and Vanuatu has always had plenty to offer in all departments, along with the welcoming smiles from the friendly Ni Vanuatu people. But according to a tourism spokesperson in Vanuatu's Chamber of Commerce, Brian Deeth, business has been slow to return to the islands after Cyclone Pam.
Generally, the town looks good and business houses are trading quite well, albeit nobody would be experiencing any sort of growth. They would be struggling to the degree that there's quite a lot of missing tourist numbers from our normal expectation. And that's simply because two of our major resorts in Port Vila are closed down until probably early in the new year, which equates to around about 5,000 or 6,000 bed nights a month. And that converts to a significant amount of income when it comes down to the economy.
But not all is doom and gloom. Mr. Deeth says tourism operators in the country are anticipating the launch of a major marketing campaign currently before government, which will see Vanuatu making it onto TV screens and papers in Australia and New Zealand in a big way.
It's keeping it a top of mind for the people that are watching TV or looking at travel ads in Sunday newspapers. These plans have been well thought out by a consultant we brought in and in conjunction with the companies that manage our marketing in Australia, New Zealand and New Caledonia.
Outside of the urban centres, the return to normalcy has been even slower. But glimmers of hope exist in even the most remote communities, one in particular being Aniwa Island in the country's worst-hit Tafea province, where a newly renovated Mama's cooperative is bustling with activity. The women of Aniwa took over the shop 3 months after Cyclone Pam, and with the help of the joint UN Community Resilience Project, now have a bustling trading hub for local produce and store-bought goods. The UNDP's David Malachi says the women worked hard to re-establish the cooperative and it is now helping them be more independent while at the same time catering for needs in the community.
So this Aniwa Mama's Cooperative is very successful at the moment. It's quite good business. It's running good with the possibility of expanding into to run a fisheries compartment within the cooperative, and hopefully the microfinance section within the cooperative.
Looking at the long term, the ease of doing business in Vanuatu has reached an important milestone with the launch of an online business registry that will reduce processing times for setting up new businesses by up to 700%. The Vanuatu Financial Services Commission says the new registry, along with recent legal reforms in the country, will also increase transparency in business and foster opportunities in communities. Commission Registration Officer Alima Garay says the reforms also cater for individuals to register businesses, which opens a new door for locals who might want to start their own version of the women's cooperative in Aniwa.
Well, in this case, it would be easier for they can just start up a business of their own without having, like, if they want to just have an ownership of their own, they can go ahead and do that even without having consent from second person.
Apart from online registration, the registry also allows businesses to maintain company details, pay fees, and receive updates and alerts from the Vanuatu Financial Services Commission, a small but important innovation in a country still finding its feet after a devastating natural disaster. This is Koroi Hawkins.
The Indonesian Defence Minister has declared that military ties with Australia are very good, but he hopes that in the future they won't be damaged by diplomatic rows. He says, as one of Australia's closest neighbours, the defence relationship should always remain top priority and not fluctuate during ups and downs as it has in the past. Samantha Hawley reports from Indonesia.
Ria Mizard Riyakudu is Indonesia's defence minister and a former army commander. He says defence ties with Indonesia and Australia are very good, but acknowledges a troubled past linked to diplomatic rows. In the past, defence ministries always followed the government, he says. When the relationship was up, it was up. But when it was down, defence ties were down as well. I hope in the future the defence ties between the defence ministries should not be up and down. We should keep going up. On boat turnbacks, the minister says different nations have different approaches. Our way is to save the asylum seekers first, feed them and clothe them, and then negotiate with the origin country. On claims that Australian officials paid people smugglers to take a boat back into Indonesian waters, just arrest the smugglers, the minister says. They should take these people back to their origin countries. We can't let the smugglers get this money while the refugees aren't getting anything. That's not right. But Ria Mizard Riakudu says the important thing is that Indonesia will respect the policies made by other countries and we will not interfere with the business of other countries. And it's our hope that other countries, including Australia, do not interfere with the business of our country. That would be perfect. Asked about airstrikes against IS in Syria and Australia's possible involvement, in my opinion, IS has been given the chance in the past year or two to stop. But when the US and Australia attacked IS in the Middle East, it's their decision, and we respect that. As for us, we are not going anywhere. We will just protect this country. We don't want any terrorists in this country. If there are, we will finish them. For the terrorists here, we do not need any assistance. We know how to handle them. There are no official figures, but at least 50 Indonesians are believed to have travelled to Syria to join IS.
And with that report from Samantha Hawley, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. If you're listening outside the target area and wish to receive a Focus Asia Pacific QSL card, let us know the time and the frequency you heard the program on. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Palmer, wishing you well. Those listening right now in Papua New Guinea, stay tuned because coming up tomorrow, you can catch a 3-time daily edition of Focus Asia Pacific, as well as the one you're listening to right now, which is the weekly edition of the program. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Palmer, wishing you well, saying so long. And take care.